Shoreshine Podcast, shining a light to the nations.
Shalom, everybody. Bill Cloud here, and I want to thank you for joining us today. We are continuing with a program or a series that we're calling The Mingled Kingdom. Now, in the previous program, we were discussing the dangers of the seed that is God's seed, the good seed, the righteous people, mixing and mingling with the other seed. And that is the tactic that the adversary has used from the very beginning. In the beginning, he seduces the woman with a mingled tree, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And then she takes and eats the fruit, and then the man, the son of God, according to Luke chapter 3, that's what Adam was called, a son of God. It's the son of God who takes and eats that mingled fruit. He corrupts himself, he's exiled from the garden, and he eventually dies. In Genesis chapter 6, it's the sons of God that mingle with the daughters of men, and this leads to the corruption of the earth to the point that God repents even making man. And of course, this is what led to the flood of Noah. But as we also were discussing, in all of these situations, God always has a remnant of people. He has those who are going to continue to be set apart, who are not going to defile themselves and coexist with the mindset of the world, and those are the ones who are spared. And I say that because the beginning establishes for us what we can expect to see in the end. So in the end of days, we can expect to see a culture that wants everybody to mix and to mingle. Things that are holy with those things that are profane. Things that are clean with those things that are unclean. Currently, we are seeing in our own country a debate as to whether homosexuals and lesbians should be married lawfully. Should they be considered equal in the eyes of the law as a man and a woman? And if a country or if a nation or if a government says that a man and a man or a woman and a woman should be treated equally, legally, in the sight of the law, well, that's what they say. But that doesn't change God's laws. And so we live in a time, if I support what God says, and if I live my life according to what God says, then I'm painted as a bigot, as a racist, all these different epithets that are thrown at people who actually believe in the Word of God. Well, that's the days in which we live. That's similar to what Noah found himself in. A day when the sons of God were mixing and mingling with the daughters of men, and you had all this corruption, all this coexistence. That's what's going on right now. And so there's always been a remnant. And it's that remnant that the adversary hates, that he wants to destroy, because the tares are sown in the midst of the wheat, not for the wheat and the tares to coexist with one another, but that the tares, getting the upper hand, might be able to destroy the wheat. So once again, all the things that happen in the beginning tell us what to look for in the end. And so in the end, we're going to see a mixed and mingled kingdom that rises. And this mixed and mingled kingdom will be at odds, will be at war. There will be enmity between that mingled kingdom and the kingdom of heaven. And those that would be accounted as the remnant of her seed, according to Revelation 12, verse 17, those who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Yeshua the Messiah. And so, in today's program, we're going to talk about that mixed, mingled kingdom, because it was foretold of centuries ago. And so we're going to go to the book of Daniel, chapter 2, and read about a very interesting dream. And so let's go and read the text. Beginning at verse 1, it says, "Now in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, and his spirit was so troubled that his sleep left him. Then the king gave the command to call the magicians, the astrologers, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans to tell the king his dreams. So they came and stood before the king, and the king said to them, 'I have had a dream, and my spirit is anxious to know the dream.' Then the Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic, 'O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will give the interpretation.' And the king answered and said to the Chaldeans, 'My decision is firm. If you do not make known the dream to me and its interpretation, you shall be cut in pieces, and your houses shall be made an ash heap.' So, very interesting story developing here. Either Nebuchadnezzar doesn't remember the dream or is not really sure about the particulars of the dream, or he just refuses to reveal those details to the astrologers. But he makes it very clear. You tell me what the dream is, and you tell me what it means, or you're going to die. Now, one of the first things that I want to point out here is that it is the king of Babylon who is having this dream. It is not the king of Rome. Why do I say that? Because so many times as we study things about the end of days and prophecy, etc., so many times people want to focus on Rome. They want to focus on the revived Roman Empire. If you've been keeping up with our program, then you should be acquainted with this concept. Because we find it in Isaiah 46, Ecclesiastes 3, that if you want to understand the end, you must first understand the beginning. Because God causes those things in the beginning to tell us the story of the end. And I say that because when you go back to the beginning, you can't find Rome. But if you go back to the beginning, you will find Babylon. So Babylon is in the beginning, and so we should be anticipating Babylon in the end of days, not Rome. So it is the king of Babylon who has this dream. It disturbs him, and he tells his soothsayers and astrologers and magicians and all these people, tell me the dream, tell me the interpretation of the dream, or you will be killed. And it, in fact, it tells us that there were people already being killed as Daniel begins to go and to seek the Lord. Now, here's another interesting aspect of this. There are at least two times in the Bible where God gives these very unique and important prophetic dreams, not to his people, but to pagan kings. As a matter of fact, the two instances I'm thinking of, here in Daniel chapter 2 to Nebuchadnezzar, and another time in Genesis chapter 41 when God gives a dream to Pharaoh. This is in the days of Joseph. Notice that both of these kings in their day were the most powerful men then on earth. And God gave these dreams to pagan kings, not to his people. However, he didn't give these pagan kings the ability to interpret the dream. He gave them the dream, he troubled their spirit, but they didn't know what it meant. And so they are compelled to call upon God's people, who both, by the way, were in bondage. Joseph was in prison. Daniel was in Babylonian captivity. Yes, he was serving the king in a high-profile capacity, but nevertheless, he was in Babylonian captivity. And so again, interesting that God chooses to give the dreams to the pagan kings, the most powerful men then on earth, but he doesn't give them the ability to understand. What I see in that, well, many things, but one is, even in our day and time, the world, the secular-minded person, the person who says there is no God, nevertheless is troubled by what is going on in the earth. They understand that times are changing. They understand that things are different. There are things that trouble them and they don't know what to make of it. The same thing in a similar fashion is happening today. But let's continue. In both cases, Joseph was called upon, the one that God put in the right place at the right time. And in Daniel chapter 2, Daniel, who was also in the right place at the right time, is called upon to interpret the dreams to the pagans, to the secularists. So now let's continue on in Daniel chapter 2, beginning at verse 19. It says, then the secret was revealed to Daniel in a night vision. And so Daniel blessed the God of heaven. And Daniel answered and said, blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his. And he changes the times and the seasons. He removes kings and raises up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and secret things. He knows what is in the darkness, and light dwells in him. So it's interesting to me that under all of this pressure, because Daniel is one of these wise men that Nebuchadnezzar has said, tell me the dream, tell me the interpretation of the dream, or I'll cut you in pieces. Daniel is one of those wise men. And so Daniel is under the threat of death, and people are being killed. So in that extreme pressure, he's living in the midst of darkness. He's living subject to the most powerful and perhaps most corrupt government then on earth, corrupt from a biblical point of view anyway. And yet somehow under all that pressure, Daniel has retained his relationship with the Creator. He's a remnant, in other words. He's still set apart. He has not been tainted with the corruption that is Babylon. And so he is able to hear from God. Because God is the one who raised Nebuchadnezzar up in the first place. Daniel just acknowledged this. As evil as he may have been, as corrupt as he may have been from a biblical point of view, nevertheless, God's the one that raised him up. God is the one who had Daniel in this place. God is the one who gave Nebuchadnezzar the dream. And God is the one who withheld the meaning of the dream. So God is orchestrating things. And so any time that God has done this, going back to Pharaoh's day, there's a mystery here. There's things that are hidden. But anything that God has hidden, God also provides the means for them to be revealed in their time. And he makes known to Joseph, or he makes known to Daniel, he makes known to those that he has chosen, those that he has selected, those that have been righteous, those that have been set apart, those that have been given the keys to the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven. That's what Messiah says to his disciples in Mark chapter 4, verse 11, when he's talking about all those things that have been hidden. There's nothing that's been hidden that it will not be revealed. And he says, you know what? You have been chosen to understand the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven. He always has a remnant. He always has a people who are, to the best of their ability, are trying to walk upright before him, to not be contaminated with the world, to not be mixed with the world. And to those people, he gives the answers to these mysterious things, to these concealed things. He tells Daniel, here's what it means. And so when God hides something, it's not intended to be hidden in the sense that these Eastern mystery religions hide things and only an elite group of people have access to these things and this kind of secret knowledge. That is not what we're talking about here. We're talking about those things that God purposely hidden, has purposely hidden to provoke his people to seek for them. He hides it from the wicked and he gives it to his people. Why? To call attention to the fact that there is only one God and there is only one who orchestrates the end from the beginning. And so at the precise time, God reveals the dream, and he does it for the benefit of his purposes and his people. Now, this dream that Nebuchadnezzar was given and that Daniel interprets for him certainly affects Daniel and those of his time, but what we see here is that more than Daniel and those the people of his time, it's going to affect people of future generations, and I would suggest to you that means you and me, the people who would be living at the end of the age. So here's something that God has hidden, so to speak, but through Daniel is going to reveal. But even though Daniel tells us the meaning of the dream, there's still some aspects of it that have remained hidden, but in its proper time, it will be revealed. Now, let's continue to read in Daniel chapter 2, beginning in verse 26. The king answered and said to Daniel, Daniel's given him the interpretation of the dream. The king answered and said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, are you able to make known to me the dream which I have seen and its interpretation? Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said, the secret which the king has demanded, the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, and the soothsayers cannot declare to the king. But there is a God in heaven who reveals secrets, and he has made known to the king, to King Nebuchadnezzar, what will be in the latter days. And so there we see that the very reason that God gave Nebuchadnezzar the dream and withheld the interpretation from all his pagan soothsayers is so that Nebuchadnezzar, the most mighty man then on earth, would know that there is a God in heaven, and he is the one who reveals secrets, and he is going to make known to Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, what's going to happen in the latter days. This is centuries ago, but this is something that is going to be revealed in the latter days. Now, Daniel, or as we read the book of Daniel here in chapter 2, here's what Nebuchadnezzar was pondering. He was pondering the dream, but what that really means, because the dream pertains to the end of days, Nebuchadnezzar was pondering what's going to happen in the future. What's going to become of this kingdom? And as he ponders this, then God shows him the dream. And that's what had him so disturbed and so puzzled. What did the dream mean? Again, he's thinking, what's going to become of my kingdom? What's going to happen in the future? Well, God gave him the answer. He just didn't understand the answer. And so let's read now verse 31 of Daniel chapter 2. It says, "You, O king, were watching, and behold, a great image. This great image, whose splendor was excellent, stood before you, and its form was awesome. This image's head was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. You watched while a stone was cut out without hands, which struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were crushed together and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors. The wind carried them away so that no trace of them was found. And the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth." So this is what you saw, Nebuchadnezzar, and he describes it to him. Now, this image is presented as being very beautiful in the sense that you've got gold, silver, bronze, all these things. But it's also described as being awesome, and that word that is used there is intended to mean that what you saw would strike fear within you. It's a fearful image, and it's a fearful image of a man. In short, what I mean by that is Nebuchadnezzar sees a body. It's a body, an image of a body that has a head of gold, chest and arms of silver, belly and thighs of brass, two iron legs and 2 feet, two feet with 10 toes, partly of iron and partly of clay. So he sees a fearful image of a body. Now juxtapose that body with the body of Messiah, because we have tree of life, tree of the knowledge of good and evil. We have clean and unclean. We have wheat, we have tares. And so now we have a body that is fearful and awesome and yet appears to be very beautiful, attractive to look at. But then we've got another body called the body of Messiah. So the essence of this dream is this. Nebuchadnezzar's pondering what's going to happen. God shows him in a dream what's going to happen, and now Daniel's going to begin to tell him what's going to happen, because these metals of this image represent the primary Gentile powers that would rise and would affect Israel. And in affecting Israel, it would dominate the world. The most brilliant of these metals was reserved for the head. That is the head of gold. And all the other images that were going to follow the head of gold would be considered inferior to the head of gold, because silver is inferior to gold, and brass inferior to silver, and iron inferior to bronze. But even though, as far as value goes, they are inferior, I want you to notice that iron is a harder metal than gold is. But in the end, the stone cut from the mountain without hands, which is representative of the Messiah and the Messianic kingdom, will destroy all these kingdoms. That's what Nebuchadnezzar saw. And so Daniel then begins to not only describe the dream to him, but tell him what the dream means. And so, in Daniel chapter 2, beginning at verse 36, he says this, "This is the dream. Now we will tell the interpretation of it before the king. You, O king, are a king of kings. For the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, strength, and glory. And wherever the children of men dwell, or the beasts of the field and the birds of the heaven, he has given them into your hand and has made you ruler over them all. You are this head of gold. But after you shall arise another kingdom, inferior to yours, then another, a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth. And the fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters everything. And like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all the others. So here's what Daniel describes for him. Again, Nebuchadnezzar is pondering, what's going to become of my kingdom? What's going to happen in the future? He has a night vision, and God shows him, but he doesn't understand it. So all of his pagan soothsayers are unable to give him an answer. And that's the way God orchestrated it, that they wouldn't be able to give him the understanding, because he gave that understanding to his people. Why? Because he wants to draw attention to the fact that there is only one God. And that one God, the God of Israel, is the one who raises up kingdoms. He's the one who raises up kings. He's the one who raised up Nebuchadnezzar. And so Daniel tells him this. Here's what you saw. Here's what it means. The head of gold, that's you. You're the head of gold. All of these other kingdoms that are going to come after you are going to be inferior to your kingdom, just like silver is inferior to gold, and so on. So you're the head. And so it is believed by most eschatologists that what we see here in this image is the head of gold is representative of the Babylonian Empire. And then you have the chest and arms of silver, which is representative of the Medo-Persian Empire. And then we have the belly and thighs of brass, which is the Grecian Empire. And then we have the two legs of iron, which is the Roman Empire. And historically, we know that's the way things progress. Babylon was destroyed by the Medes and the Persians. The Medes and the Persians were conquered by the Grecians, and the Grecian Empire broke up. And then we have the evolution of the Roman Empire. So that is historically the way it happened. But what I want to call attention to is this, that Babylon is the head of gold, the head of gold. Now, going back to this analogy that I was making between this image that Nebuchadnezzar saw, if you will, body that Nebuchadnezzar saw, and the body of the Messiah. In the body of Messiah, I might be part of the elbow or part of the hand, or you might be part of the foot or whatever. Wherever we fit into the body, we all understand this, that we all get direction from the head. Because the head of the body of Messiah is the Messiah. He is the one who tells the arm what to reach for. He's the one that tells the leg where to walk. He's the one that tells the foot where to step. He's the one that tells the hand what to grab. He's the one that gives us instructions. Everything emanates from the head and goes through and affects the entire body. So then, if this image that Nebuchadnezzar saw is, if you will, a body, Babylon is the head. And so where does the chest and arms get its influence from? The head. In other words, where would the Medes and the Persians get their influence from as it relates to what God is doing in the earth? It would be Babylon. Where would the belly and thighs of brass, the Grecian Empire, where would they get their influence from? It would be from the head. That would be Babylon. By the way, Alexander died in Babylon. He made his capital in Babylon. Where would the two iron legs, which are supposed to represent the Roman Empire, where would they get their influence? It would be the head. You see, a lot of people focus on the legs, the Roman Empire, revived Roman Empire. And the Roman Empire, if they're the legs, and I agree with that, well, I would suggest that the legs take the body where it wants to go. But who tells the body where it wants to go? It's the head. It's Babylon. So what I'm trying to get across here, ladies and gentlemen, is that this dream that Nebuchadnezzar had was not only to give him an answer, but it's, as we read in the text, Nebuchadnezzar was being told what was going to come to pass in the latter days. He was being told what was going to come in the end of days. And if we believe that we're living in the end of days, then one of the things that we need to take away from this teaching today is this, that our focus shouldn't be on the legs so much as on the head. If Rome is the legs, so be it. But what is the head? It's Babylon. And so this other body, not the body of Messiah, but this other body represented by this image that Nebuchadnezzar saw had as its head, this head of gold, was Babylon. And so all the kingdoms from that point forward that were going to march upon the earth and conquer the earth and influence God's people, even in some cases enslave God's people, every one of them would receive their influence directly from the head. And that head is Babylon. And Babylon, ladies and gentlemen, is the epitome of mixing and mingling. And so if that's what we have at the head, at the Rosh, or at the beginning, what would we expect to see at the end? And so if you want to find out more about this, join me next week, because we're going to continue talking about the mingled kingdom. Shalom.
Like what you're hearing? Become a BillCloud Premium Partner to watch or listen to hundreds of hours of teachings and resources on demand. Go to BillCloud.com/subscribe to start watching today.